Call the committee to order.
As my legislative assistant fix on me a little bit. Not too badly, though. We have a quorum here, and I see that Representative Beard has read the minutes thoroughly and makes a motion to approve the minutes from yesterday. All in favor of approving the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? That's the Hemmingson. Hearing so, I think that motion passed. And again, we have the Environment and Natural Resource Committee with cellulosic biofuels, although we may hear a little bit about that today. Is going to have a hearing on it again tomorrow, even more so. And they're bringing in people from out of state, and I'm thinking it's someone from Princeton. You know, I suspect if I asked the guy at the table, he could probably tell me exactly who's going to be there tomorrow. But it is highly recommended if you get a chance to go listen to them. And then the we have the tour on Friday. Mm-hmm. Hopefully everyone can be there. With no, any other comments from the members? Elsewise, I will ask, welcome Dean Robert Eldy to the committee, and thank you for coming today and giving us the presentation. So, please start.
Thank you, Chairman.
Identify yourself for the record and start.
And I was just about to do so. My name is Robert Eldy. I'm Dean of the College of Biological Sciences and Chair of the University's Initiative in Renewable Energy and Environment. Very pleased to have the opportunity to meet with you this morning and continue the discussion about biosciences as it applies to economic development and the several sectors of bioscience where Minnesota's economy can and should profit from investments that you have made over the past and we hope will continue to make in the future. The Biobusiness Alliance, I think Dale Wallstrom probably shared this concept with you that you'll see on the screen right now, and that is biotechnology can be divided into several sectors. And the sectors are maybe the simplest of those divisions is what you see here, red, white, green, and blue, with red being medicine, and that's one that is, of course, of huge importance to the state of Minnesota, to the University of Minnesota, Mayo Clinic, and so on. There are other sectors that are maybe less well understood, nevertheless are extremely important. And as Dean of the College of Biological Sciences, we say in our cut line to students we attract and recruit to our college, come and enjoy a world of opportunity, explore a world of opportunities from molecules to ecosystems. And indeed, this bioscience industry that we're talking about today spans that entire spectrum. So we have many of our faculty and students are deeply involved in biomedical research. We have many who are deeply involved in ecosystem research and everything in between. We're going to spend most of our time this morning discussing, because I know you've spent a fair bit of time in this red sector, we're going to talk mostly about the white and green sector. That is industrial biotechnology. Biotechnology applies in part to agriculture. And we won't say much about aquaculture or the so-called blue biotechnology. There are, of course, many other ways of dividing it, and I have here in my hands a very pricey book. It's published by Burrell and Company. Steve Burrell grew up as a Wisconsinite just across the border. Steve is the director of an investment banking firm in San Francisco, and he publishes annually the Bible that analyzes what has happened in what he divides into, I think, 11 sectors of biotechnology. So, you know, he slices the pie into more pieces. And this is an extremely interesting but daunting kind of task to read this annual report. I just received the advertisement for the next edition of this.
Dean Elmy, if I might stop you. I should find out how would you like to handle questions at the time people come up with them or... this is a pretty chatty group, so I will tell you that your answers, shorter answers are shorter questions, and shorter answers are always better so that our presenters can get through. That book I've actually heard of a couple of times, and if you have a comparable book that might be less daunting? The chair would love to have that recommendation, and I will see about finding out if other committee members would like to have a less daunting but just as informative book for that.
Chairman Boney, thank you. I think we can find, if my colleagues can note that, we'll come up with one that may not be nearly as pricey. It may even be a free book that is less daunting. So it's interesting if we think about these sectors and their economic impact. And several years ago, we asked some consultants, Heath Lukacs, who was at Piper Jaffray Ventures, he ran their San Francisco operation back then, and Jim Kalamas, who was at McKinsey at the time, to assess what the economic impact had been in what were three sectors that we're talking about. The aquaculture stuff isn't on here. Back in the year 2000, and what they were estimating the economic impact of each of these sectors to be in the year 2010. So this was, I think it was in 2002, when they made this analysis and these predictions. And they determined that in the year 2000, the impact of biotech in healthcare was about $13 billion. In agriculture, it was $3 billion. This is actually ag chemicals, just the ag chemical sector. And then industrial biotechnology, to everyone's surprise, was already in serious ways bigger than either of those two, the two of them combined. Hmm. And if you notice their estimates of where this train was expected to be in the year 2010, which is not so far away now, healthcare was about a three-time escalation factor, ag about six times, ag chemicals. And notice this industrial, it's almost a 20-fold increase in activity in this sector. Now, I don't show this to you to say this is exactly where the train will be in the year 2010, but I think if you do read books like this, you'll see that this is not far off. The trends are there. And what's surprising is because of perhaps the personal impact that the healthcare industry has on each of us, we pay a lot of attention to that. And yet these other sectors are huge and in some cases may dwarf us. So today I'd like to explore a little bit about that. And the glimpses that we're seeing in this ag and industrial sector have a distinct Minnesota brand to them. And to that end, I'm not going to dwell very much on what we call bio-based products, but you have one at your desks. Mm-hmm. This bottle of water, if you'll notice, has a little green label on it. This, like corn-based ethanol, is corn-based plastic. Okay? And this is a Minnesota invention. This was invented by Patrick Gruber, who was at that time at Cargill. He's a graduate from the University of Minnesota. He decided that there ought to be some better way to make plastics than from crude oil, and that those plastics would not only be made from a better source, but they could have a better destination in terms of their outcome, in terms of the health of our ecosystems. You may have noted that a variety of sources are reporting that the world's oceans are being badly contaminated by floating barges of plastics that are drifting about, imperiling fishing fleets, the fish themselves, and so on. Those plastics, petroleum-based plastics that we've come to depend on so greatly, simply do not degrade. If you were to degrade them, they would be greenhouse gases, and worse, because there are toxic ingredients contained within that plastic as well. So the intriguing thing is this is, although the water's not from Minnesota, the water in this case is from Colorado, every time one of these bottles is made... Perhaps in glacial times, you know, but every time, if you will, a bottle of this or another bio-based plastic product is sold, if you will, there's a ka-chink in Minnesota's economy because this was invented here, and there's some economic spin-off. And I'll come back to that ka-chink in the economy as we go down the pathway to talk about biofuels and why we believe it's very important for the next generation of biofuels to be invented in Minnesota, for those inventions to be commercialized here in Minnesota and to take root in Minnesota's economic climate. Because wherever the second and third generation of biofuels will be produced, there ought to be ka-chinks in Minnesota's economy. And that's the point I want to make in addition to the side of producing bio-based fuels.
Can we drink them now?
Yes.
Absolutely.
And I think I took this from Autumn's desk, so someone could have this one back. I only needed to wave this around for the purpose of illustration. So although we're not going to dwell on this, I think the case for investing and pointing toward a future that uses bio-based fuels and bio-based products is coming from lots of different sectors. Please.
Representative Hodge? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick question. At one time, this was a great plastic, and everybody was really excited about it, but it was biodegradable only if it was hit by sunlight. Has that been solved?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's now, I think it has been solved. I don't think sunlight is required for it. Enzymes are now available that actually in an ordinary compost pile, this will be degraded in 60 to 80 days.
Thank you very much.
So composting is sufficient to break it down. So I'm not going to dwell. Many of you met last night in the what was historic joint multiple committee session and heard about a variety of environmental and global warming concerns. In addition to that, of course, the cost to consumers of dependency on petroleum and the way we've become, both in terms of where it comes from and what that requires in terms of our foreign policy and energy security are at the forefront of a lot of our agendas today. There's really this growing sense of urgency that, and a really interesting move from the industrial community and the investment community to circle around and look at where economic gain might be made by investing in a more sustainable future. And I show here just the headlines from a variety of popular media sources that document that. You've been seeing it really in all of the media coming on in spades in the past few months. This urgency is articulated by our leaders, major parts of State of the State, State of the Union, major concern about the way we're going and what we might do to turn the corner and how we might participate in that economy, a bioeconomy that is surely coming around the corner. And it's interesting, too, the breadth of now understanding of the consequences and the opportunities for averting the kind of global climate change that may be pressing on us. What is perhaps most interesting is some of the most risk-taking individuals in society are putting serious resources on the line. This is from the Bloomberg Market magazine, the cover story, and this is a picture of Vinod Khosla. Khosla is a very interesting person because he grew up in India, spent his developing years in India, trained as an engineer, came to California, and he was the co-founder of one of the legendary microcomputer companies, Sun Systems. So he was the co-founder of that, went on to leave that company, but to be a managing partner of what is most arguably the most successful venture capital firm in the world. The firm is in Silicon Valley. The firm is now named Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers. Khosla has been the managing partner of that operation. They were the first money in Google, the first money in Yahoo. They've been able to survive the bubbles that have occurred in a variety of markets, and they've come out on top. So interesting about Khosla, given his background, is that he continues to work with Kleiner Perkins, but he's peeled off his own firm called Khosla Ventures. And I would encourage you to look at his website, Khosla Ventures. You can just Google that. You'll find him. That new investment firm of his is investing exclusively in biofuel startup companies. They have a portfolio of six or so amazing startup companies from the leading scientists around the country. One of those has some roots here in Minnesota. There actually is more activity on the part of Coastal Ventures in launching companies here in Minnesota. What's also very interesting in the Minnesota connection is that Doug Cameron, who was a professor of chemical engineering at University of Wisconsin-Madison, was recruited from Madison to be the head of biotechnology system-wide at Cargill, was stolen from this community by Khosla to be the chief scientific officer for his entire portfolio of biofuels companies. So a Minnesotan, if you will, he still maintains his residency here, is now the chief scientific officer of this portfolio of the world's leading second-generation biofuels kinds of companies pointed in that direction. Kosala sees the power of the market and the ability to leapfrog over the dilemmas that we're staring down and sees an economic future by investing mightily in these new technologies. He also sees the implications of this in third world and developing countries, having grown up in India, and his other passion is micro-lending in developing countries in this space.
Dean Ellie, Representative Beard?
Mr. Chair, Dean Ellie, I can't make out his name. Could you spell it for us?
Yes, K-H-O-S-L-A is his last name.
O-S-L-A.
First name is Vinod, V-I-N-O-D.
V-I-N-O-D,
Vinod. And if you Google Kosala, you'll... Coastal Ventures, you'll find it. Very, very interesting story.
K-H-O-S-L-A.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Please continue.
Thank you. So, whereas there's a very interesting history that in which Minnesota has a pioneering and leadership position in the development of the first generation of biofuels, that is corn-based ethanol, things are happening at a very, very rapid rate. And the question facing us is, what do we need to do as a community to maintain and extend that leadership position? What will be the consequences if we do or if we do not? So states are vying for these, and I'll illustrate that in a few moments with a map. Universities are seeing the incentives based on federal initiatives for steering faculty effort and creativity in this area, and companies are investing dramatically. If we look on a state-by-state basis, and I'm not going to dwell on this, you can read it faster than I can read it to you, but as we look around the country, whereas we had a preeminent and pioneering position, other states and other jurisdictions are making big investments. Some of the biggest investments are just appeared with the question marks. BP, formerly known as British Petroleum, has dangled the possible investment of $500 million to a single research university over a 10-year period to be the epicenter of biofuels research. As a non-public institution, they're free to do this in any way they want, and they've been quite secretive about their process involved in this. We've made contact with them and worked very seriously because, as I'll outline, I think we have a great head start with our initiative in renewable energy and the environment. But I'm sorry to say that in the past few weeks, as they're coming down to their decision-making, the line has gone cold. So we actually don't know if we're in the running. I kind of doubt it, or who will be. Please.
Was that with BP or with the federal government?
This particular one is BP. And our intelligence suggests that MIT has been probably in the running on this whole effort, and the consequences of that being developed in Massachusetts would have negative consequences, we believe, here in the heartlands. Another initiative that is, I think, the one Representative Chairman Mahoney is just referring to, and that's the Department of Energy issued a request for proposals back in July. This request for proposals was to award to two successful grantees $125 million over a five-year period to create a very focused research program in a new generation of biology, a kind of biology for which we nor other universities have yet to have a department. We have departments of molecular biology, of system of plant biology, and so on, but none of us have a department of systems biology. Systems biology is a new generation of biology that follows genomics, follows proteomics, follows metabolomics. It's the leading edge of how you put all of those new omic forms of biology into a new way of thinking and cracking the code. So this is a request for proposals, and I'm pleased to say, and I have hot off the press, this was literally printed this morning before I came here, this is the University of Minnesota's application. It was sent electronically last night. I just received a phone call saying our application was accepted by the DOE. So we are now one of 70 applications that will be considered over the next 6 months for one of these $125 million centers.
Thank you. I think there's a question. Did you have a question, Representative Norton?
Thank you very much, Representative Mahoney. I'm wondering, one of the things we heard with the biosciences as we've had these presentations is that there are investments similar in other states that we're competing against, and in fact, we're told that it's not too late. Given what you're telling us, if we do not get the federal grant, which hopefully we will, and what's happening with BP, are we going to be too late to invest, or is it worth getting in the race in the biofuels area, in your opinion?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton. Very good question. I've been dean for the past 12 years at the University of Minnesota, and I have to say that I think for both reasons inside the University of Minnesota, within our higher ed system in the state, MinSCU, within research entities within the state, as I'll illustrate, the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute, I think we're, in fact, uniquely positioned to do very well. This is one of those niches where we're not too late. Arguably, we are too late in terms of making a big dent in the in biopharmaceutical biotechnology. If I could just digress for a moment and answer that question, we had an opportunity to be a leader in that area 30 years ago. We had on the faculty at the University of Minnesota Professor Paul Boyer. Paul Boyer was trying to get traction back in the 60s. Early 70s to launch an initiative in molecular biology. I think we were too busy doing other things. Supercomputing was a big thing in this community and at the university. The medical device industry was big at the university and in this community. And I think we couldn't take on molecular biology as yet one more thing. Boyer left here and went to UCLA to form the Institute of Molecular Biology. And since that time, he and two of his colleagues who he recruited to the faculty shared Nobel Prizes in molecular biology. There are 18 members of the National Academy who are members of that institute. It became one of the elite institutes that spawned the biotechnology industry in California. Another person was in our community, not at the university, but over at 3M for 19 years, trying to get traction at 3M in molecular biology. George Rathman left here, went to Abbott Labs in Chicago for 2 years, went to California, to Los Angeles, where Paul Boyer was, and founded Amgen. Amgen is the biggest and largest and first of the biopharmaceutical biotech companies in the world. So it was as if we had an opportunity with those two leaders here. We couldn't make the investment then. I think it's too late for us to reel time back in and pretend we could go back and create an Amgen and a Genentech and all of its brothers and sisters here at this stage. In this space, I think we are in a very good position, in part because of what the legislature did 4 years ago to enable us to create a launching pad that I'll describe a little bit more in the form of our initiative in renewable energy and environment. Please.
Okay, now, just so I'm clear here, because we had a presentation from MGI Pharma, and I think what they said was that most of these biomedical firms are not profitable. Of the 36 listed on the stock exchange, less than a dozen, maybe seven are profitable, and Amgen being one of the seven, if not the premier one, and we had the guy here, and we let him go. Okay, I just wanted to make that clear.
Exactly right. So, Chairman Mahoney and members of the committee, I just to say a few more words about this grant application. This is the largest application that has ever been submitted for federal funding from the University of Minnesota. There's never been an opportunity of this scale. Yeah, having an opportunity of this scale is what brought out 69 other entities to compete with us. So this is truly an amazing opportunity. And I have to say that whether we succeed or fail, I'm so pleased with the amazing effort on the part of leadership of the faculty within the university as to the projects. There are 48 initial inaugural scientific projects and 9 educational projects in the body of this grant. These are amazing projects that build on what we've done in terms of the investments we've been able to make thus far, supported by Xcel Energy ratepayer money. Whether we succeed in this application, we will be shopping these projects because they are crucial to Minnesota's economic future and vitality in this biofuel space. We'll move on from this. I also just want to use this to emphasize that we're not just competing with Iowa and Wisconsin and the Dakotas or other California, daunting competitors here within the U.S. we're competing with nations. This biotech stuff, as you've probably gathered, Singapore is doing amazing things in terms of creating the Biopolis, a whole city devoted to bioscience and biotechnology built from the ground up. China, in this space, this is the world's largest ethanol plant in Jinlin, China. The paradox is it's the largest plant, it's ultra-modern. The feedstock, the corn that is brought to this plant, is harvested by hand and brought there by burros and horses. It is amazing the kind of technology leapfrogging that is happening, so it's not just us. And I'd like to say that no matter where biofuels are produced in the world, there will be new technology, new enzymes, new organisms, new membranes that will be used in the processing to make those biofuels. And I would like that technology to be Minnesota invented and Minnesota manufactured, because that's the leg up that we can get. That's the leg up we have in the medical device world. Everywhere in the world where a pacemaker is implanted, there's not only benefit to that person who receives the pacemaker, there's not only economic benefits to that community in terms of hospital employees, physicians, and surgical technicians, there's a little ka-chink in Minnesota's economy, most likely, because that device was most likely manufactured by a Minnesota-based company. We need that analogous kind of ka-chink in Minnesota's economy by inventing the next generation of biofuels. We've had some amazing progress with this 4 years of funding as a consequence of legislative action that created the funding source for IREE. Many of you may have heard last night Regents Professor Dave Tillman and what I think is in this biofuel space at least the equivalent of the Honeycrisp apple, if not more. That is, by realizing the potential for producing biofuels in a carbon negative, not a carbon neutral, but a carbon negative manner, this is far, far more than the Honeycrisp apple for economies here and worldwide. We have faculty who've taken up the bit and have engineered bacteria to create powerful fuels in, as we say, hours instead of millions of years for fossil fuels. We have faculty who reasoned that there might exist in this diverse world of microbes that live in places as diverse as the hot springs of the Yellowstone Geyser to the deep depths of the oceans, that there are interesting metabolic pathways and new chemicals that can be produced by harvesting the genome of these bacteria. And indeed, they have found bacteria that essentially do what geologic time and geologic forces took to make crude oil. They have bacteria, as we speak, very limited quantities thus far, making crude oil directly from corn. You can make ethanol from corn. They said, why can't you make alkanes, the chemicals that comprise crude oil? And indeed, they've discovered the pathways that can do that. There are really interesting opportunities that I'll highlight again in just a moment. Woody biomass is a tremendous resource, both here, I mean, here we are in Minnesota. On the one hand, we're the breadbasket. I would argue we are the fuel basket. And that fuel basket is not limited to agricultural crops that we can grow, but the forest industry is crucial for this. But we have to be able to harvest the molecular entities out of that woody biomass to be used for making fuels and products. We have people who, for the first time, have, I think, cracked the code on breaking down the tough stuff that makes wood stand tall. That is, the lignins that are mated to cellulose to make lignocellulosic polymers. Those lignins are now degradable thanks to the groundbreaking work of people on our faculty, and that is something that's going to be a key. We need to take that finding, as I'll emphasize again in a few minutes. We need to use the commercialization processes in place here at the University of Minnesota and at the state of Minnesota. There needs to be a startup company not too far down the road that takes root at another favorite place of mine that Representative Mahoney and I talk about quite often, UEL, University Enterprise Laboratories. We need a startup company there that commercializes this work. And then we need the big manufacturing facilities that make tons of these enzymes and distribute those and sell them to the world. and I'm sorry, here, one of our favorite faculty members who you've probably seen many times over, Lanny Schmidt. For some reason, the PC to Mac conversion is not friendly to Lanny, and his picture was blacked out here on my map. Lanny is a Regents Professor of Chemical Engineering and is the world's leading authority on creating hydrogen from biological sources. And he's done amazing work, and we're sorry that his photo somehow got blacked out by the Mac. And then, as I emphasized here, products that can be made will replace current plastics and fabrics and polymers made from crude oil.
How prevalent is this biodegradable plastic in the bottled water industry, the bottled soda pop industry? This makes so much more sense. Is it that much more expensive? Is it limited quantity of production? I can't understand why I should ever bring a plastic bottle into my house again. So could you expound a little bit on the on where they are in distributing this and what's hindering it, if not?
Chair Mahoney, members of the committee, that's a very good question. One thing, it's somewhat limited in its applications right now in the beverage industry, because if you notice, your bottles are probably have a slight dent. This was bottled probably 9 months or a year ago in Ouray, Colorado, high up in the Rockies. And this plastic, as it comes, this bioplastic as it comes out of its current process, is not a perfect barrier. Okay? The reason there's a dent here is the water slowly evaporates. So over the 9 or 12 months it's been in this bottle, there's been water loss due to evaporation. And as a consequence, the bottle is dented. When it was bottled, it was full and round, plump. Okay. So that is a killer fault for bottling carbonated beverages, okay? Because they would go flat within a few weeks. So it simply, as currently rolling out, can't be used. But, of course, you can imagine there are a lot of people working on improving the barrier properties of this plastic. And so we're expecting very soon that partners working with Cargill and with other entities are creating improved versions of this bioplastic that has barrier properties sufficient to make it usable for carbonated beverages, including beer, perhaps, if that would have a bigger impact. So that's one issue. The other issue is this material is being sold as fast as it can be turned out from the polylactic acid producing plant that Cargill has built down in Blair, Nebraska. You know, one of the shortcomings I feel is that this product was made where it was invented here. All the R&D was done here in Minnesota. When they came to building their $300 million manufacturing facility, if you will, all of those pipes and tanks and fermenters were located down in Blair, Nebraska. You know, for economic reasons, I guess. I wish there had been some way for incentives to be made that would have been located here in Minnesota. It's down near the intersection of all the grain shipping operations in the U.S., near the corn wet mills, and so there are a variety of reasons it was located there, but it's too bad that it, as a Minnesota invention, it kind of snuck out of our, the first big large-scale manufacturing snuck out of here. I think so since they're selling all they can make, and new modifications of this are coming online, I think this market is going to expand dramatically. It has further positive value features when you can start making it, as is the intention, to make it from biomass instead of from kernels of corn. And so not too far down the road is the prospect, and I hope we could be pioneers in helping that take root here in Minnesota's economic soil, of making these bioplastics, biofabrics, and biopolymers from biomass, hopefully the kind of diverse prairie biomass that Dave Tillman has advocated could be the feedstock that could make these plastics of the future. In addition to the immediate discoveries and inventions and commercialization that we as your research university intend to do and have done some of, what we're perhaps best at, the product that we're most successful at turning out and will long-term have the greatest impact, is the students that we train. So, as you know, undergraduates and particularly graduate students are parts of the research teams, crucial parts of the research teams. They're the people who are at the bench at 2 o'clock in the morning tending that reaction, overseeing that petri dish, and making certain the experiment's going in the right direction. And because they're being educated in the process of creating these new technologies, they are the workforce that will carry this into the future. And I'm pleased to say, for example, that over this 5-year run of IREE, there will be 125 newly minted master's and graduate students. About 75 of them will be have written PhD theses on their work in developing biofuels and renewable energy. That is a tremendous workforce that's coming out that can populate, help commercialize and populate the companies, as well as replenish the academic supply here in Minnesota and in our region. As you all know, we are a leader because of actions taken by the legislature in terms of putting incentives of several sorts out there to get ethanol into the market. And so if you look at the map of ethanol refineries in the U.S., they're headquartered here in the heartlands and particularly here in the state of Minnesota. Just a few words about what we've done with this $220 million that was given to us by legislative action 4 years ago. This was action that mandated that Xcel Energy's funds collected from Xcel Energy's ratepayers be delivered to the University of Minnesota. In particular, $10 million of resources from the Renewable Development Fund, which, as you probably know, was authorized as a part of the Prairie Island reauthorization of nuclear waste storage. $10 million of that Renewable Development Fund, if you will, a tax on nuclear waste storage, was sent to the University of Minnesota as a lump sum. And then the Conservation Improvement Program over the past 4 years and one more year sends 5% of its proceeds to the University of Minnesota, a sum which totals about $2 million per year, and over the 5 years of this legislative mandate will add another $10 million, which totals $20 million in all. We have funded a total of 115 million projects. They range from seed grants, which we did initially, which ranged from $25,000 to $50,000, to some large grants, which are approximate $500,000 and have multiple investigators from multiple units and have a lifespan over 2 or 3 years. These have involved tremendous mobilization of faculty and students from across all reaches of the university, faculty from the medical school, faculty from the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences, from our Institute of Technology, from the college I direct, Biological Sciences, from the Humphrey Institute, from across the quarters of the university. There's been this amazing outpouring of expertise that's come to bear on these efforts. There are more than 100 external research partners, ranging from people in industry to partners at universities and colleges around the country and around the world. We've used this to leverage $14 million of federal funding from DOE and National Science Foundation, USDA sources, and the scope of activities ranges across the spectrum that you see illustrated here at the last bullet at the bottom. We've listed here some of these partners in particular that have helped us generate these exciting research projects.
Dean Ali, if I could interrupt just for a moment. You know, you have in the audience here, hopefully, some future scientists. They are young people, that young students, and I, you know, I'm not sure, ninth grade students from the St. Croix Preparatory Academy in Stillwater are here. And I want you all to know that this committee is working on your careers of tomorrow. In the biofuels and the bioindustry, they pay really well, very good wages, but he was just talking a little earlier about 2 a.m. petri dish checks. That might be a problem, but I'm sure you could find a younger student than you to do that. Welcome to the committee today. This is a committee that tries to look towards the future and what the state could be 20 years down the road, which is probably way more important to you than it is to us because we're all trying to figure out how to retire. But thank you for coming today, and I hope you pick up something, and I hope you go to school under this particular gentleman in the near future, not too distant future.
Chairman Mahoney, members of the committee, and guests, particularly from the school in St. Croix Valley, this is very germane because it truly is imagining the kind of opportunities and creating opportunities. I've said to a number of people, I've become tired of attracting great young minds like we see here today, only to train them for the workforce in San Diego, San Francisco, and Boston. We're here to create economic opportunities to live out their creative and productive lives here in Minnesota. So, welcome. As I have tried to emphasize and try to do so graphically with this map, we have operations across the state of Minnesota. Indeed, you know, the Twin Cities campus of the university is here, but virtually all of our coordinate campuses, our research and outreach centers, have a piece of involvement in this. Not only is it the University of Minnesota system, it's also partners. For example, a very exciting partnership that I'm pleased is a part of our application to the DOE with the wider community. Some very interesting opportunities appear to be arising in partnership with them, both educational demonstration and research. With our colleagues at the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute and their sites in Crookston and other places within the state, and with our colleagues in the MinSCU and private system. I'm so pleased how this coalition has come together to address this. So we're not one entity sort of battling the other in our quest for serving the state. We are serving and prepared to serve the state together. Pleased also that some great informal institutions that are world-renowned in their capacity for informal science education, the Science Museum of Minnesota. I have to declare in full disclosure that I actually serve on the board and executive committee and as treasurer of the Science Museum, so I have another strong interest in what they do. And the Wolf Ridge Environmental Learning Center are also partners with us on this endeavor to help ensure the pipeline sees young people see the opportunities that can be afforded here in this state with focused efforts in this renewable energy and sustainable approach. There are amazing opportunities here as we see them, both interesting scientific challenges that, as I'll say again in a moment, kind of rival the moonshot. I grew up as a beneficiary of, I'm old enough to have grown up in a small town north of Seattle. I was in elementary school when Sputnik went up, and I remember the pretty vivid calls by our leaders of our country and the implementation of science programs in those days. That certainly, I have to say, inspired me to think that I might be able to do something in science as a career. There are those kinds of moonshot opportunities in this space. They're intriguing and really interesting once you dig into the exotic science, but they're also very practical. So we have a risk. I think we're out there ahead of the pack, but we're at risk of falling behind, and there's a kind of a window of time when this thing will close, as we've illustrated here. And I don't know, my colleagues, my director of communication, happened, if you look very carefully at this closed window here, you'll notice outside the closed window are some tombstones that I realized only, I don't know if she directly or inadvertently included those tombstones, but there are... This window will...
Is that kind of a message?
I think so. So what are the challenges? So on the one hand, this whole notion that has become so popular, President Bush a year ago in his previous State of the Union address said we're a country addicted to alcohol. He mentioned the S word, which was switchgrass. And it seems like that future, that kind of bioeconomy based on cellulosic ethanol, because it is right around the corner. We're seeing so vividly what's emerging as the food versus fuel conflict. As corn prices are going through the ceiling, that's great for our friends and colleagues who are growing corn, but it's also potential chaotic situation for people dependent for either using that corn as feed for their livestock or for human consumption. So there are, and it turns out that whereas it's easy to talk about cellulosic ethanol, and there are some really interesting technologies and some companies that are perhaps on the verge, this seems to always be 5 years away. Like a cure for cancer, it seems like it's 5 years away. So I think that is clearly why the Department of Energy asked a lot of us to get to work, because they had invested $40 or $50 million over the past decade in trying to use what had been available to engineer the enzymes to break down cellulose into the sugars that can make ethanol and other biofuels. And those enzymes have been improved an order of magnitude. That is, they're 10 times more efficient, they're 10 times cheaper, but all of that has still been a glass ceiling to making this economically viable. And so the DOE considered and did, you know, convened experts, and they said, you know, tweaking what we've done with a few more tweaks is not going to get us to that next breakthrough, another tenfold improvement that needs to happen. So that's why this whole proposal is focused on systems biology to take the new genome, proteome, metabolome biology to the next level and focus it in a laser-sharp manner to engineer the enzymes, to engineer the organisms, to crack the code on cellulosic ethanol and cellulosic other biofuels. So it is a moonshot. And I said, and maybe a bit irreverently, you know, after the president's most recent State of the Union address, he announced an aggressive plan to, in 10 years, reduce by 20% our consumption of gasoline. A quarter of that would be by energy efficiency, and that's extremely welcome to see that in terms of energy efficiency and fuel efficiency in vehicles. But three-quarters of that is to be made by increasing our output of ethanol. And as you may have read or heard from Dave Tillman, if we devoted the entire U.S. domestic corn crop to ethanol, we could do 12% of our gasoline could be replaced. We simply can't stare down that kind of a future. So we've got to get from here to there in cellulosic ethanol. So really it's a moonshot to get from here to there and to get to other forms of fuel that actually have better properties than ethanol. And I'll say a few words about that in a moment. And I said a bit irreverently and quoted in the Scrib the other day that the president's proposal that he is going to devote over the next 10 years $1.6 billion to this research turns out to be a pretty pale drop in the bucket. I mean, it's a huge amount of money. There's no doubt about it. $1.6 billion is nothing to sneeze at. But on an annualized basis over 10 years, that's $160 million. If we look at the budget of federal agencies, NSF has an annual budget of about $7 billion. NASA has a budget of $17 billion. The NIH has a budget of $29 billion. And somehow we're going to crack this code with $160 million per year. So $160 million compared to those billions. It's as I said, a slingshot to try to get to the moon. So we're going to have to continue to press this agenda and work together, you know, within the resources we have as a state and a region, and in partnership with the private sector and get the public sector at the federal level to understand the magnitude of the investment that's going to need to be made. This is a start on that pathway, but it's hardly the destination. What do we need to succeed? We need to devote a portfolio of technologies. There's not going to be one magic bullet, one silver bullet. Some have said it's going to take silver buckshot, not a silver bullet. And I think that is really true in this space. We need to expand our educational programs to bring young people into this pipeline to contribute their creativity and insights to make this happen as we go forward. And as I just said, the resources are going to be necessary to drive this. We're moving toward a much more complex picture of energy and fuel. I mean, at the moment in time, we have two principal sources for energy and fuel. We have crude oil and we have coal. Minnesota is typical of the Midwestern states. 75% of our electricity comes from coal. It's come from coal at that rate for about the past 30 years, and we've not made a very big dent in changing that. The consequences of burning coal and of using crude oil are, of course, have consequences that, as you've been hearing about, and we talked about at the beginning. But instead of having the current oil refineries where the input is kind of simple, it's crude oil in and it's gasoline out and some other aviation fuels and so on, we're going to see the biorefinery of the future is going to be much more complex, and it's going to vary dramatically on a region-by-region basis, depending on what you can grow in your fields and forests. So the biorefinery of the future is going to have inputs of the sort that you see here. Of course, corn, soybeans, trees, sugarcane, perennial grasses, we hope are a huge part of the solution, and so on. The conversion processes are going to be about three, but they're going to have a lot of subsets within each of these three. They're going to be biological conversion processes, that is, enzymes and organisms like yeast and bacteria. They're going to be thermochemical processes, where you've got to heat this stuff up and bust it apart with caustic chemicals and high temperatures, and then mechanical processing to break it apart into smaller bites, if you will. And then what is really interesting is the output. The output is going to be very sector-specific. And we're going to be able to dial, I think, between the inputs and the outputs and dial up what we want out of these biorefineries as we go down the future. There's a blurring of distinctions, particularly now if you look at grid-level electricity and the possibility of plug-in hybrids. You know, who would have thought, as I talked to our colleague Dick Kelly, CEO of Xcel Energy, I said to him the other day in a conversation at the Science Museum, did you ever think you'd be in the transportation industry running an electric power utility? And he said, absolutely not. He said, you know, and this is a bit facetious, we might, if we could get this plug-in hybrid stuff going, we might be able to never have to build another big power plant, coal-generating power plants, because we can recharge them with cars running around and plugging into the grid and recharging. Now, of course, that has some downstream effects on what you power the cars with, but nevertheless, there are interesting blurrings of distinction between fuel and power. And these products are going to come out in very interesting forms. It's going to take a lot of money if we use current ethanol technology, and that's why the R&D effort needs to be applied. And I'd like to just introduce to you, if you've not already heard about it, about some of these second and third generation biofuels that seem kind of almost science fiction, but they're starting to become real. So this is a Volvo study, and Volvo has a collaboration with Dave Kittleson, who heads our university's renowned diesel research center. Kittleson and his colleagues both look at emissions from diesel engines and work to reduce that, and also experimenting with a huge array of potential alternative biofuels for use in diesel engines. And from a diesel engineering perspective, one of the brightest stars on this horizon is a compound abbreviated DME, dimethyl ether. So dimethyl ether is a very interesting chemical entity that can be made very efficiently from biomass, from woody biomass, and in fact from a really interesting waste stream that we have in abundance here in Minnesota, black liquor, as produced from our pulp mills up in northern Minnesota. It can also be produced, and we're in conversations with our friends at the Metropolitan Waste Facilities Commission, the sludge from our waste sewage treatment facilities has a huge content of latent energy that with gasification technology could be processed and DME could be harvested.
Do you know him?
Yes.
I'm not sure I heard the entirety on the pulp industry. What can we get out of, or what are you looking at getting out of the waste stream of the pulp industry?
So, Representative Mahoney, Chairman Mahoney, members of the committee, we're looking at a variety of products that could be harvested from that energy-rich waste stream, black liquor. There's a startup company that has a demonstration facility in the northern parts of Sweden. The company's called Chemrec. And that company is currently making dimethyl ether out of the black liquor that's coming out of some Swedish pulp and paper mills. We're in conversations with them as well as other scientists and companies to see what might we do in Minnesota to harvest DME. And let me just tell you two really interesting uses of DME that could be applied fairly quickly. One of them is DME acts at standard temperature and pressure like propane. Okay, so if you're going to use it for a diesel engine, it requires little conversion of the guts of a diesel engine, but it requires a different fuel delivery system and storage system, like you use compressed natural gas. for powering fleets, okay? And that technology has been worked out. So not only is this really interesting for fueling fleets of buses, for example, it's been calculated back of the envelope that the black liquor coming from one of the big pulp mills in northern Minnesota would provide sufficient dimethyl ether to power the entire Met Transit bus fleet on an ongoing basis. Okay? It's likely that the similar back-of-the-envelope calculations, the sludge from our waste treatment plants, could do the same thing in powering fleets. It's difficult to imagine immediate adoption by transcontinental trucking fleets, right? Because I can't quite imagine the transition to every diesel station around on the freeways of the U.S. having a DME filling facility right away. But fleets that are fueled at central locations, like a Met Transit system, look to be really interesting long-term for this use. Another really interesting use of dimethyl ether, it's a perfect replacement for propane. And in places, in rural communities in our part of this country, if you don't use a wood-burning stove, you use propane to heat your home or your office. So we can easily imagine a transition to producing dimethyl ether from biomass, woody biomass, or the waste effluent from pulp mills, and changing that into dimethyl ether and using that in applications for home heating, for off-grid home heating in rural communities in Minnesota and the upper Midwest.
Just a moment, Dean Elder, Representative Norton, you had a question?
Yes, Representative Mahoney. Committee, Dean. When we talk about these various, and there's a wide variety of different types of fuel, how does this roll out into what I have out in my parking garage, which is a Chevy? Are all these fuels going to be interchangeable? And the example that you gave a moment ago is really what triggered my thought, is we may be able to start here, but if you can't get that sort of fuel someplace else because there isn't enough, can cars switch back and forth from a variety of fuels, or how are we going to engage the car industry to help move this forward? And it sounds like it almost has to be done, if I'm understanding this, and it does require some sort of different mechanics in a car. It would have to be done nationally, not simply locally. So if you could address that for me.
Chair Mahoney, Representative Norton. That's a very good and apt question. We think that these diverse possible fuels will find niche applications, at least at first. For example, hydrogen. We've all been very excited about clean burning hydrogen, the possibility for hydrogen. It's difficult to imagine hydrogen quickly at its first place of adoption being for automobile transportation, just because of the challenges that you outlined. But, for example, there's a company in Vancouver, British Columbia, that is a big warehouse operation at the port of Vancouver, and they have forklifts. They're powering their forklifts with hydrogen because they can generate the hydrogen right there. They've got a fleet of forklifts. Instead of recharging the forklift battery with electricity and having the forklift work really well for the first 4 hours of the 8-hour shift and then start to sag during the last 4 hours of that shift, this fuel cell-powered forklift works with 100% efficiency throughout that entire worker shift. So they're going to be, the technologies will be improved around niche markets and niche applications. But we may well be not living in such a simplistic society. We may, like we have flex fuel vehicles being made now, flex may take on a much broader meaning. It may be more flexible than just gasoline up to E85. It may have other, so the word flex may expand in its meaning as we go forward.
And can I just go a little bit further? Thank you. As you're moving forward, and you clearly already are thinking for the future, I personally have had a frustration in trying to find fuel-efficient cars and American-made cars, and there's not much out there right now. Is there something that the industry is doing to help engage the current car industry in this country? And I often wonder if there's something we can't do at the legislature to encourage fuel-efficient cars in the future. I just wonder if that communication is taking place, that we might move to a better place rather than, you know, what I feel has been kind of stalled out for a number of years now in this area.
Chair Mahoney, Representative Norton. That's a very good point. I mean, for example, just last week, I think it was, or the week before, we had a symposium at the university called Minnesota's Stake in Plug-in Hybrid Technology. And it was extremely interesting. You know, we have a great Center for Transportation Studies at the University of Minnesota. They and Irie co-sponsored this thing, and we had some authorities from around the country, as well as our people together. And it's clear that there's a strong push scientifically to help find technologies that could be adopted to help that issue. And I think it was a very positive first sign ever from our president when he announced that fuel efficiency standards need to be improved on our vehicle fleet, automobile vehicle fleet. So incrementally, I think we're starting to see that, but the frustration is clear. There are clearly ways to make our cars much more fuel efficient by using lighter weight materials for the cars, by a whole variety of things that could be implemented. And I think it is going to take action by legislative bodies, state and federal, to realize this possibility. I'd like to just finish up with this slide and say that the reason I showed this to you, if you notice on the left side, you can make dimethyl ether from natural gas, but then it's fossil fuel-based dimethyl ether, right? The purple bars are meant to indicate essentially the energy content, because the energy content of ethanol, as you know, is somewhat less than gasoline. The energy content of DME on a per mass basis is almost as good as diesel. Okay, so it's a winner on that front. And on the right side, if you look at these blue bars, you'll notice that DME from wood or black liquor is almost zero in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. Okay, so compared to burning diesel from crude oil or making DME from natural gas. So moving towards sustainable and renewable feedstocks for making this next generation of fuels is really, really intriguing. You know, there are incentives out there. As a university, for example, we've joined the Chicago Climate Exchange. We trade carbon credits. As we reduce our carbon emissions, we trade that for cash. This is a way of reducing carbon emissions. You can imagine part of the financial solution to this transition and this pathway is going to be carbon credit trading. So entities that could switch over and use dimethyl ether, either for home heating, heating their business, their office, or fueling their fleet, have the opportunity to join entities like the Chicago Climate Exchange and trade those carbon credits. This can help finance that pathway. It's not just a government handout pathway to financing this future. I'd like to wrap up here and just say, you know, I think it's the role of a research university like ours, your research university and Land-Grant University for the state of Minnesota, to come up with inventions, discoveries that will disrupt the status quo. This word, disruptive technologies, it's interesting to Google that. Some people say disruptive. Kind of skitter back at that. But if you take this word in the sense that economists use it, an example of a disruptive technology can be seen, for example, with the iPod. The iPod has disrupted the music industry forever. The music industry will not, as you know, some of us grew up with 45 RPM singles and 33 RPM LPs and all that kind of stuff. And then we saw CDs. The iPod has changed it forever. That's an example of a disruptive technology. If we're going to get off the path that we have been on for 100 years, 150 years in terms of fossil fuel dependence, we've got to come up with disruptive technologies. Technologies that will be competitive in the marketplace, adopted by the market. It is, in the end, the market that's got to make this stuff happen. There are certainly incentives and to get through transitions that you folks with the authority you have can help make this transition. But in the end, we've got to find at its core technologies that disrupt business as usual. And I show an illustration here, and I mentioned it already, and this illustrates a tree. And it illustrates, at a microscopic level in green, these polymers, the lignins that are in trees, and then the action of this enzyme that our people are in the process of discovering and characterizing that will break that down so biomass from trees can be dumped into that fermenter instead of kernels of corn to make ethanol or to make one of these other second-generation biofuels. That's an example of a disruptive technology that I think we need to invent, that we need to work together with partners to commercialize,
And at places, as I said before, like UEL, a startup company needs to exist and be nurtured. And then we need to go down the pathway of scaling this stuff up so the commercial, so there are jobs for people like our young people here in these companies, in these facilities that are manufacturing these enzymes and selling them to the world. And we have an example of this future. If you see here in the middle, there's a lot of stainless steel, expensive piping and tubing and bioreactors. And this is from what is really arguably one of the most modern molecular manufacturing facilities in the world, and it's here in Minnesota. It's not a Minnesota company. It's a California company called PDL, Protein Design Labs. They built this $250 million molecular manufacturing facility about 3 years ago in Brooklyn Park. This is manufacturing medicines. It's manufacturing monoclonal antibodies for human therapeutic applications, as in cancer. And we need to build, in the end, if we're successful, 5 or 10 of these molecular manufacturing facilities that are making the enzymes, that are making the membranes, that are making the organisms that are used by the biofuel industry worldwide. So if someone's making a biofuel in Alabama or in Albania, they're using Minnesota-based materials and technology so that the ka-chink in Minnesota's economy continues to occur as it does at the moment in the medical device industry. This will then have opportunities so that not only will rural communities benefit from producing the feedstock for producer-owned facilities that produce the fuels, but it will also have a manufacturing sector rejuvenated here in Minnesota that ought to have a long, long future. The extent to which this, these biofuels are sustainable in ways that generations after generations of our grandchildren can use those and improve those, there will be opportunities in Minnesota's economic marketplace to develop this. So with that, I think there's really an interesting future that we are poised to have opportunities to capitalize upon as coalitions of people from your education communities, from the industrial community, from the grower and producer communities. And I think we really, with all of that, have unique attributes that if we play it right, can put us out ahead and be the winners in this very competitive landscape. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dean Aldi. You teased us with in conclusion, and about 5 minutes ago, we put his hand up, and yeah. So I'm going
to
call in.
Fine. I appreciate the opportunity to ask, and it fits better after the end than during anyway. When we're talking about some of the waste products and then converting them to a biofuel, such as a bark sludge, from a wastewater treatment plant would be interested, because there's not a lot of places that it's real popular to dump this from the city to the farm. And I, you know, it's very easy to appreciate the power that could be rejuvenated from these waste products. When the president was talking about switchgrass, then I got into a mode of, you know, when the U.S. gets on something, we're going to go really, really fast. But are we going to keep it in balance and look for disruptions, if you want to carry on with that term, to the possible ecological niches and webs that I know very little about, and I'm trained in the field? And is there going to be people that are safeguarding that so that we don't do the same thing and we're looking back and saying we did the same thing to the bluebird or to the wood duck or to the black ducks of, you know, and because there's a lot of little tiny things that wander around in switchgrass, and if you keep harvesting it, I'll bet you'll find out what they did.
Chair Mahoney, Representative Haas. No, that's an extremely good point. I mean, that's what I have to say I'm perhaps most proud of with respect to our university's initiative. The name of the initiative is Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment. There are many other universities. I just got a flyer yesterday. University of Michigan has a new institute on energy. It's energy by itself. It's not energy and the environment.
Yeah.
Other entities, and in fact, the University of Minnesota has recently created a new institute on the environment in which our work on renewable energy and environment is located.
I think your point is extremely well taken. What I find as an amazing convergence of opportunities is the pathway that we're taking, planting every possible square acre of Minnesota's landscape into corn to capitalize on this corn prices as we see them going with this food-fuel collision. That is not healthy for Minnesota's ecosystems. The possibility of restoring vast stretches of our landscape into prairies that have the possibility for long-term carbon capture and providing a source is really intriguing. I mean, this is a twofer or a threefer. Now, your question also alluded to the possibility of little things, be they wildlife or microscopic life, that might be occupying those niches that might be disturbed by the harvesting practices. Is something that really has to be examined carefully. We think there's probably a fine line that could be walked. I mean, for example, it may be that some forms of biomass could be harvested right now while everything is frozen and while those critters are hibernating, if you will. I think this gives us an opportunity to look very holistically and see how we can steer this into a truly sustainable, not just a kind of a metaphorically sustainable future.
Mr. Chair.
I'll represent.
When you're thinking about it, you know that those grasslands did burn off and rejuvenated themselves. So they, before we took over the planet, they did take themselves out. And when you're riding around this summer and you're driving by corn, at that time that was the tall grasses. And when you're driving by the grains and the wheat, that was the wild short grasses. So you can tell where the prairie grasses grew and what size they were grown by the crops that we grow there. Thank you.
Interesting. And just to add on to that, I've had discussions with a couple of people around this building. We invest a lot of money in trying to clean up the rivers with the RIM money and the CREP money, and there's certainly some point we should probably look at how we direct those funds to grow, because the prairie grass, as I understand it, takes approximately 3 to 5 years to become self-regenerating. To figure out ways to do that, that would certainly help as we move forward.
The pheasant hunters will thank you for the effort.
I was going to tell the story of the fellow that I'm going to go see this evening at my union meeting that is trying to work on putting hydrogen into his house with a hydrogen generator in his garage. I won't go into the details of the concrete walls he's building around it, but people are starting to see this and starting to think about this and how we do this. And then he's all these pheasant hunters that I will be seeing this evening, I will be trying to bring that up also. So. Are there any other questions for Dean Elvey? I'm sure you have some of the slides that you had. Some of them were very, very interesting to me, and as I continue to try to harangue or lead or convince my colleagues that these are great ideas and how we do this, I may be taking advantage of those. And hopefully you've got that other free book or less daunting book. Seeing no other questions, I'm going to adjourn the meeting. Thank you again. We appreciate that. Before we do go, I'm going to... I got two things, the Environmental Natural Resource meeting tomorrow and the stars from the East and West Coast or wherever they're coming from. And then the St. Jude's tour on Friday. We're no longer going to do a bus, we're going to carpool, and I will have Autumn try to touch base with people trying to make that all happen correctly. No, again, thank you.